Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
From the independent producer project of KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of stories and personal documentaries. And today on the program, a very strange story of a mentor and his protege. The actor Montgomery Clift made films through the 50s and 60s like A Place in the Sun, From Here to Eternity, Judgment at Nuremberg. He was a heartthrob, and there were rumors he was dating Elizabeth Taylor. But really, Monty was gay. He had to hide his real self for the sake of his career, like a lot of actors back then. Then in 1956, he had a horrific car crash, and his career was never the same. He got addicted to alcohol and painkillers. He died in 1966, mostly because of the alcoholism. According to some people, he'd always been tortured and depressed at having to live a double life. So now, 40 years later, an up-and-coming young actor and writer named Craig Chester goes to visit a psychic when he needs some career advice. But instead, Craig gets some totally unexpected news. He has been followed by the ghost of Montgomery Clift for years. From KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional, and I am Montgomery Clift.
It was a horrible accident. He'd broken off his jaw on both sides, teeth were knocked out, and his nose was broken and crushed. It was a horrible accident. It came on the news that Montgomery Clift had been in this automobile accident, and I found out where he was, the old Cedars. And Monty said to me,
"It was a result of just plain tiredness after shooting."
He went to this dinner of Elizabeth Taylor's, and he left early, and he fell asleep at the wheel of the car and ran into a telephone pole coming down from Tower Road.
When they showed me in the hospital a picture that was in the paper of the car, I couldn't believe I was in the hospital bed. It was so demolished.
He was suffocating. Elizabeth realized that he'd knocked out his teeth, and his teeth were down his throat, and she put her hand into his throat and pulled out his teeth, or he would have died.
And I must say, my face was about as disfigured. I was all bloat. As a friend of mine said, "The only thing normal about you is your ears." I wouldn't recognize myself.
I woke up in intensive care. I had three operations. The first operation was to rebuild the roof of my mouth. The second operation, they rebuilt my upper jaw. And the third operation, they gave me a chin. My face was swollen. My mother was standing over me. And my mom leaned down and she said, "Sweetie, it's over." My name is Craig Chester. I'm a writer. I used to be an actor. It's really surprising and shocking that I wound up becoming a film actor, considering I grew up with a deformed face.
My name is Parker Posey.
When I met Parker for the first time in 1992 at a party, it was like, "I know you. Hi, there you are."
We just hit it off.
And we've been friends ever since.
He felt like a brother to me. He just had this artistic integrity as a young gay actor. He did this movie called Swoon that was really well received.
But my acting career fizzled out, so I started writing. And I wrote a screenplay, which was called Adam and Steve. I was being pursued by, you know, big agents in Hollywood to come out to L.A. and go on meetings to direct these really big budget, you know, movies. And now I have this opportunity to go to Hollywood and make some real money, but it's not really what I envisioned for my life. And so one of the actors in my film suggested that I go see this psychic named Reverend Catherine on the Upper East Side.
I am an interfaith minister. I do spiritual counseling. And I'm a clairvoyant medium and a healer.
I'd never been to a psychic before. I just didn't believe in this stuff. But I decided, you know, why not?
I opened the door and Craig was standing there.
She was very sweet and she wasn't wearing a turban. She looks like Mia Farrow. I sat in a chair and she asked me why I was there. And I said, well, I don't know what to do with my life. I'm in a sort of a crossroads.
All I could see was this other presence.
The whole time that I was talking to her, she's looking over my shoulder at something that's not there.
This great-looking, tall guy. And he looked familiar, but I did not know his name.
She interrupts me and she's like, the spirit of a dead gay actor around you, and your next film is going to be about this man. And my initial reaction was, it's not why I came. I mean, I was there to talk about me, not about some dead gay actor.
He was very driven to get his story out.
I said, is it Anthony Perkins? No, he's not Anthony Perkins. Is it Rock Hudson? And she's like, oh, no. You know, she's looking at this figure behind me and saying, no, he did not like Rock Hudson. So finally I say, is it Montgomery Clift? And then she sort of comes alive, you know, and she's like, oh, my God, he's jumping up and down. That's me, that's me, that's me. I'm Montgomery Clift.
He was saying, I need to get through to him.
She starts talking to him a minute. He's been around me my whole life. You're having this life he couldn't live because of the time he lived in. I was going to write this piece for him. I was going to set the record straight about his life. She's like, did he die in Manhattan? Because he's showing me this brownstone, and he's going to get you in there. He's going to get you into his house. She got choked up. She got teary-eyed. Oh, Craig, he's been waiting a long time for this.
Yes, I had never known anyone like Monty. The first day we met on the Warner Brothers lot, I'm playing the sailor, and when we went to be introduced by Merv Griffin, Monty is a priest, Monty's dressed as a priest, and I'm a sailor, and it's like a crazy porn movie time. And but anyway, we hit it off right away. He liked me very much. And so we'd see each other on Warner Brothers lot, and we became great friends right away.
I sort of put it out of my head, and I went to L.A. But I thought about when I was young. You know, 20 years before, I had facial reconstructive surgery. As a result of it, my jaw was wired shut for 2 months. And so during that time, to sort of pass the time, my father rented a bunch of old classic movies for me on VHS. One of the movies was A Place in the Sun. And my parents were gone for the afternoon. You know, the opening of that film, Montgomery Clift sort of backs up and then he turns right to camera and it's this extreme close-up of his face.
I certainly didn't want to bother you at home.
I had a visceral reaction to seeing him for the first time.
I hope you remember.
And then I got scared. It was the middle of the day, but I got up and I locked all the doors and I closed the garage door. I just felt afraid.
When we see each other again like this, tonight's been wonderful.
Monty would not leave me alone. He would say something and I'd call Craig. And then I found out that Craig went to L.A. and met this lady, Josanne.
I went to a dinner, this business associate of my father's.
Craig's dad would always say, you have to meet my son.
Sam and Josanne, normal, happy people.
And we met for dinner.
We were at Orso. You know, they were asking me the questions that everyone asks me, which is, you know, who's gay in Hollywood? So I started outing people and telling them names, and they were sort of clutching their pearls and gasping. I said, well, it's always been this way, you know, in Hollywood, Rock Hudson, Montgomery Clift. Josanne, who'd sort of been quiet during the meal, she came to life.
And as soon as he started speaking about him, the auric field got bigger on his right side.
I didn't know she was a psychic. She's not a professional. She just does it for the sake of helping people. She sat up and turned away as if she was listening to something.
I mentally asked this energy right next to Craig, are you this guy? He said yes.
And then she turned back to the table and she's like, Craig, this Montgomery Clift guy,
he's attached to your hip right there, you know?
She doesn't even know who Montgomery Clift is. She said Cliff without the T at the end. Sam is so hysterical. Once Josanne took over, he just sort of sat back and started drinking his wine. Might as well have been looking at his watch. You know, his wife talks to dead people. She's like, he's been with you and you're having this life he couldn't live because of the time he lived in, and he's sort of living vicariously through your freedoms, and something about like car accident and your face and his face, and he wants you to be the one to like tell the story, and he doesn't like who he's been represented, and his house, he's going to get you into his house where he died. And I remember asking her, do you know this woman in New York named Reverend Catherine? And of course she doesn't. And I was completely in shock. After the dinner, I was very shaken up, and I called Parker.
I think I was in a cab.
We were laughing about it.
It's just so good, you know? It was like, are you kidding? Are you, what?
Parker was like, oh my God, this is so Shirley MacLaine.
This is really out on a limb, you know?
My first instinct was to just find a logical explanation for this, but there wasn't any logical explanation because they told me the exact same thing.
Bobby Lewis, who was a great acting teacher, said that Monty's was the slowest suicide in memory. I don't know what the problem was. People say, oh, it was because he was so guilt-ridden or something about his sexuality. Not at all. If he was feeling comradely, when we'd walk, he put his arm around me, around my shoulder, and we'd walk on the street. He did not care, but he also was very private, did not do publicity.
Considering the kind of roles I play, I can't suddenly throw off the mask and have lunch with somebody.
So basically committed to being in LA for like 6 months, you know, and sort of see what happens with this sort of, you know, will I be a comedy director? I rented a place in Silver Lake. And a few days after I met Josanne, she called me and she said, well, Montgomery Clift is here and he's ready to get to work on his script. So do you have a pen? He's going to talk to you through me. Kind of humoring her, I said, yeah, go ahead. I've got a pen. And she pauses for a second and she says, I'm sorry, Craig. Monty just told me that you're lying. I'm in this rental. She doesn't know where I'm staying. She starts to describe my house to me. Literally specific details of the place that I'm staying. And she says, is there like these stairs with this dark wood at the top? There's like a little vestibule. And I'm standing in the thing she's describing. And she's like, that's where Monty likes to hang out. He hangs out in there. And I'm jumped out of the vestibule like scared. That's when I started to pay attention. She started calling me every day. Monty started talking about his life.
As a spirit, as a soul, Monty is a joy, huggable, pure.
I started to write a biopic. The mission was really setting the record straight. Unintended.
He wasn't pleased with all of the misconceptions.
You know, he sort of went down in history as like this tortured closet case, you know, and he died at 45, you know, of alcoholism. Monty is also giving me like career advice, telling me to go back to New York.
Monty was a guide for him. That's how I sensed it. But there was something that was not complete. And that's why he chose to live through Craig.
I remember going out to lunch with this acquaintance of mine, and I think he noticed that I looked really tired or something, and I'm like, I'm just going through this experience, and I don't know what it is or what's happening, but I think Montgomery Clift is haunting me. And he looked at me and he said, oh, I completely understand. A few years ago, I was walking through Union Square and I heard a flower talking to me. And I picked it up and it was the ghost of Charles Lindbergh. And that was a moment when I thought, I'm never telling anyone ever that this has happened to me. That's your biggest fear, is that people are going to think that you are thinking the flowers are talking to you. And then one day, I had just pitched a female mud wrestling comedy and was leaving there feeling pretty full of shame at what I had just done. I get in the car and the phone rings and it's Josanne and she's like, Monty's very upset.
He was kind of annoying me sometimes.
He hated Hollywood. He called it Vomit California. Gave me a lecture about artistic integrity, basically, and not to sell out. And I remember thinking like, you know what? I need a job. And then Josanne said, he's going to sabotage every job that you're up for. And I didn't get any of those jobs.
There's a French writer, Francois Mauriac, who wrote the phrase, we are molded by those we love. And I would say in a lot of ways, I was molded by Monty.
So while this is all going on, I met someone.
My name is Brandon Roberts.
I fell in love with him at first sight. It's the only time that's ever happened in my life.
I knew that Craig had this friend, Josanne, and he would talk to her frequently about the other side and that kind of thing.
We were like teenagers, you know, it was like really, really, really big love.
He definitely wasn't hiding it, but I think he was probably really fragile about how he was going to present this to this new guy that he's dating because it sounds crazy. Josanne is like verbalizing these little clues and Craig is finding them and going and making them happen.
Josanne called me and said, Monty has a friend who's still alive in L.A., who's Jack? Someone named Jack, some guy named Jack. You've got to find this guy named Jack. I knew that Monty had a relationship with Jack Larson, who was Jimmy Olsen on the Superman TV show in the 1950s. And so I said, is it Jack Larson? And she's like, yes, he's saying Jack Larson. You've got to find Jack Larson. There's 60 Jack Larsons in LA. So I go to bed frustrated.
Literally like 24 hours later, he would get a phone call from someone saying, hey, I'm going to have lunch with this guy, and I really think you should meet him. And it just so happens to be Jack Larson.
You know, it was like these strings were coming down from the universe, and he was like tying knots with them.
Without doing anything, I was on the phone with Jack Larson.
He was nothing like anybody thought he was like. They think of him as being introverted, super serious, and he had the greatest sense of humor of anyone I've ever known.
Keep pouring.
No, thanks, I don't drink. I think it's a weakness. I don't like weakness. Do you?
No, I don't like weakness, but I like to drink.
He basically backed up everything that Monty was telling me through Josanne.
He did not care that anybody would say, oh, he's, you know, he likes guys or something like that. We were deeply involved for a couple of years, and then it just wasn't possible. I lived here, I worked here, I did things, but I always had a room in Monty's house in New York.
Ultimately, I did go back to New York with my boyfriend, and we started renovating my apartment in Hell's Kitchen, and Josanne kept calling me, Monty kept calling me, continued to, like, you know, fill me in on his life.
It was like someone falling madly in love with someone else that isn't available.
I was completely submerged in the experience. I completely surrendered to it.
It was as if he was, you know, palling around with Montgomery Clift, getting to know each other and falling in love. Yeah, for sure. 100%.
You know, it was a triangle.
You know, Brandon would come home and he would want to do things and I'd be on the phone with Josanne or Catherine talking to Monty and he would be upset with me.
I could do anything I wanted to do in New York City, and there were endless possibilities. And then I would come home, and then we'd be talking about, like, Monty.
The more that I talked to Monty through Catherine and through Josanne, the more that I felt truly understood.
It sounds so weird. It sounds so crazy. But yeah, how do you compete with a ghost? I can't.
I felt understood in a way that Brandon could never understand me, in a way that no guy I'd ever been with had gotten me.
I love you. I've loved you since the first moment I saw you. I guess maybe I loved you before I saw you.
Lincoln Center has the Montgomery Clift collection. I started going there to do research. When Monty died, his sister donated all of his screenplays and his plays and photos and his personal things to this collection. I took off my gloves. I wanted to touch them, which is against the rules. And there's a security guard who's watching everybody. And he came over and tapped me on the shoulder to tell me to put my gloves back on. And I felt this like rage bubble up inside of me. And in my head, I was thinking, these are my f***ing things. My reaction scared me. And I remember leaving there and crying, feeling like I didn't know where he began and where I ended.
He kind of spun out for a while. I think he spooked himself.
I became obsessed with Monty, like obsessed with Monty. I stopped sort of taking care of myself.
This happens in life when you're an artist, being lost and being found again. And it does feel like you're being kind of messed with.
I believed that it was real at that point. Everything that Josanne and Catherine were saying to me, I believed it all. I would walk down the street and I would be arguing with Monty, talking to myself on 10th Avenue. And then stop and realize, like, I'm the guy that's talking to the flower.
You can't explain it, but you're there feeling it. What are you going to make with this? How are you going to bring this into the real?
And I'm walking over to his brownstone on East 61st Street and just sitting across the street and smoking a cigarette, even though I'd quit smoking.
Are you going to break out of this? Is the sun going to come out, or are you going to stay in the dark?
I just felt comforted being across the street from his house, which is the house where he died. And so, like, not too much longer after that, it was my birthday.
Made a cake and, you know, invited all of his friends, that kind of thing. And out of nowhere, Craig gets a call.
My friend Bob, and he said, you know, I've been invited to a cocktail party tonight. I wondered if you wanted to come with me. It's in Montgomery Cliff's old brownstone.
It just felt like everything was leading up to that point. It was one of those things where it's like, well, I can't compete with that. So yeah, Craig, go.
I remember that image like so clearly of pulling away from Brandon. There's something about that moment where I feel like we did separate in some way, because there was a look of, like, I guess, rejection and sadness in Brandon's face. That I almost like I chose Monty. When I got to Monty's house, I walked in and I was overwhelmed. It felt like there was someone on my shoulders. Like, I felt heavy. I felt like I weighed like 400 pounds. It was literally as Monty had left it in 1966. Like, the wallpaper, the hardwood on the floor was coming up. It was like stepping back in time. And there was a man named Paul who lived there. Told him that I was working on something about Monty, and I said, can I see the bedroom where he died? And he said, well, he didn't die in the bedroom, he died in the bathtub. And he knows this because the woman who lived there, her husband was Monty's attorney, I think, and Monty had been on a bender for days and changed the story to make it less sordid. The following Wednesday, I get an email from Paul. I know you're working on this Montgomery Cliff thing, and maybe this is morbid, but would you like to spend the night in Monty's bedroom? So, you know, the following Wednesday at midnight, Paul gave me the house. So I shut the door and I walked up the stairs. I felt this heaviness again. I walked into Monty's bedroom. I sat on the bed, and for an hour and a half, I sat on the bed staring at the tub. And I knew that I had to get into the tub.
When we die, and let's call it heaven, and we go to heaven, we are dwelling in a space of pure love, joy, peace, okay?
I had this desire to feel as close to him as I could, like to get this right.
But what happens is a soul starts to forget that they're actually in heaven because it's all they're experiencing.
And so I got in the tub and I laid back and I remember looking up at this air vent and thinking like this is the last thing he saw.
Craig isn't Monty's reincarnation, but there's a soul connection that is so deep that they, it's like a transference. One is the same as the other.
My heart was pounding in my chest. I looked down and could see it pounding in my chest. I was so afraid and I didn't know why. I felt like this sort of druggy vibe.
So what often happens is a soul will say, okay, I'm ready for a human experience.
And I heard a voice in my head say, this is no accident.
I'm ready for a life in the physical world.
I know what this feels like. The ultimate goal as an actor, there's this abandonment of self and you're gone and there's someone else in the driver's seat.
And we come back.
After that, it pretty much died down. Brandon and I broke up, and then Monty was gone. You know, I felt a real sense of loss in a way. Josanne told me that I had everything that I needed, that Monty was basically done with me. Josanne said that Monty was like, right. You know, go right.
Monty had a letter from Thornton Wilder that he carried around. Monty had a rather large wallet, and he had this letter in the wallet. The letter was an answer to a question that Monty had asked Thornton Wilder as a young man. Is there a God? And so he wrote this letter to Monty, Dear Monty. And Monty loved this letter, which is now a bit tattered. He was folded up in this wallet. And Thornton Wilder's answer was, there is a bridge between life and death, and that bridge is love. I've never had an experience that I believe that Monty's spirit was with me. His spirit is with me. Monty is with me because I have this great love for him. Still.
I Am Montgomery Clift was produced by Nick White and Darby Maloney. Story by Craig Chester. Story editing, mixing, and additional music by me, Bob Carlson. Vital production help from Ross Tipograph. And since this story was first broadcast, Jack Larson passed away at the age of 87. This episode is dedicated to him. You can find many photos of the people in this story and other information at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional, where you can also find an archive of all the past episodes of this program. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The associate producer is Nick White. Follow us on Twitter @Unfictional or like us on Facebook. But most importantly, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from kcrw.com.